everyone, we are doing something a little bit new with this episode. I will not be interviewing a professional disc golfer who's either an up-and-comer or a name you know and love. This is my first interview with a mental game professional. I will be doing this in future seasons where I bring an expert on a particular topic related to the mental game and they kind of give us a rundown of their work and how it can help people with their struggles. And this week is Brent Oliver, known to most as Purple. I hope you enjoy and let me know if this kind of interview is something you want to see more of in the future. Thank you all so much for listening. Our numbers keep growing and I'm so appreciative of all the positivity and support. You're very awesome. Thank you again so much.
I'm not a speak softly and stay calm sort of mindfulness coach, right? That doesn't work for me. Doesn't work for a lot of my clients. I know what it's like to be just hopeless and miserable and out of control and to feel like you can't change anything. Take care of your mental health and don't worry about how it looks.
Welcome to Basket Case, the podcast where disc golfers tell you the stories of when their mental game had the power to make or break their rounds. Let's gain some experience, work on our brains, and hit some chains. This week features Brent Purple Oliver. Brent is a professional mindfulness coach who specializes in disc golf, and he's worked with big names and small. He was a painfully shy kid who became a spectacular disaster in his 20s, like most of us. Hear his journey, learn more about mindfulness, and how it can increase your enjoyment of the game and decrease the suffering surrounding it. Hi, Brent. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing lovely. I like your shrine in the background. I didn't notice that last time we talked.
Oh, yeah.
In the same room. Very zen. I love it. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast as my guest. So far this season, I've mostly talked to pros. So this is really cool to have an expert like you to talk about kind of how you can improve players' mental game, like really directly. I wanted to start off talking about your background and how you got started in mindfulness, kind of the journey that took you to where what you're doing now.
Yeah. God, it's been a long one.
I'm 48 yeah, 25 now. Years.
Yeah, just about. I started meditating when I was about 23 or 24, just out of sheer desperation. I was miserable. I was waiting tables and bartending and a despicable creature, like totally caught up in the, I don't know if you've ever waited tables or been in the restaurant industry, but it is a lot of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And I loved it. You know, at first I was 21 years old and I was like, well, this is perfect. I'm a college dropout. And now here's this world that was apparently created just for me. But it got old really fast and became very destructive. So yeah, I just got to the point where I was kind of teetering on the abyss, just about ready to give up and throw in the towel, and just kind of stumbled across a book on Buddhism and meditation, bought it, read it, and was like, well, I can give this shit a try. You know, what's it going to hurt? Things are already pretty bad. It changed everything. Yeah. I've always kind of listening to people tell stories that like somewhere in there, they say, and it saved my life. You know, you're always like, was it Batman? I mean, there's always sort of that skepticism or that eye roll when I hear people say that, and that's just a me problem. But yeah, it totally did save my life. I definitely wouldn't be here without it. So yeah, that started me out on the path, and I kept practicing, but I also kept waiting tables and bartending, which I did until about 4 years ago when I started doing this full time. It took a long time to get enough clients to be able to make ends meet, you know, starting out in something like this, especially something like mindfulness coaching, where a lot of people might not know exactly what it is. It took a long time to get here. But yeah, you know, I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up until I was like 42.
Like so many people.
Yeah. Yeah. I sort of came to this through pain and misery. Kind of everything turned around.
Where are you based out of?
I'm in Lexington, Kentucky, but I only have a few clients here. Most of the people I work with, I work with Zoom or Skype or phone calls.
For those who might not know, can you go through what is mindfulness?
Like James Brown is the godfather of soul. This guy named Jon Kabat-Zinn, who's a medical doctor, is the godfather of modern mindfulness. He works at UMass, and he created this thing in the 70s called MBSR, which is mindfulness-based stress reduction. And he started using it with patients who had chronic pain. And he just developed this program over time that incorporated mindfulness. And that's sort of what got it rolling. His definition, I'm paraphrasing, was always sort of the gold standard. And it's something along the lines of mindfulness is paying attention in a specific way to what's happening in the present moment without judgment. A lot of people use that as their sort of overarching definition. The way I teach, I like to get very specific about things. So my primary teachers, the people that I've worked with, tend to define mindfulness as a set of three skills: concentration, clarity, and equanimity, that are all working together for the purpose of improving your life.
I can definitely see just offhand how those things can come together in disc golf. Before we get into like the deep parts of each of those three, which I definitely want to talk about,
Sure.
you are very unique in as like mindfulness coaches, particularly as it pertains to disc golf, because you're an avid disc golfer and you've been disc golfing for quite a while. So tell us
Yes.
about your background in disc golf and
Well,
how you got
that
started
felt
doing
almost
that.
like kind of a jab. Like, I've been disc golfing for so long, I should be better, right? Like, it's a
Oh, no. That's how everyone feels, though, too.
Well, that might be, but yeah, I came to disc golf when I was like 32 or 33. And it didn't have nearly the following or the professional structure that it has now, although it was on the way up and up. But yeah, just a friend introduced me to it. He'd been playing for 10 years just as a hobby. Within a few weeks, I was better than he was because I'm a nerd. So when I get into something that I like, I tend to research it and go all out.
Same.
So I went from borrowing one or two discs from him to buying six discs. And then when I figured out you could order them online, I went to Disc Golf Center and Clearwater Disc Sports and started purchasing discs willy-nilly. So I instantly became that geek on the course. But yeah, I kind of got to a level of recreational competence that I thought was pretty decent. So I entered my first tournament probably about 5 years after I started playing and just hated it. I didn't like the pressure. It took what was a fun, relaxing, enjoyable hobby for me and made it into something that even at the rec level was competitive enough that I didn't enjoy it that much.
Yeah, that's so amazing for you to have like the self-awareness to recognize that in yourself and say, this is just a fun hobby. I'm gonna keep it as a hobby. I feel like most of the times we find out, I mean, me in particular, I do this all the time. I try and make my hobbies my jobs.
No, yeah, I do that a
Something
lot too.
should stay hot. Something should just stay hobbies.
Well, I actually, in that tournament, it was two rounds at what at the time was the longest, most technical and challenging course that we have, where I typically shot anywhere from like plus five to plus 15. So we played the first round in the morning, and then everybody had an hour and a half for lunch. So I went and got food, but I also went and got Jägermeister and I snuck that into my bag. So on the first round, I shot eight up. And in the second round, sneaking drinks of Jäger from my bag, I shot three up. So not only should this maybe stay a hobby because it's too competitive for you, but also I don't think they let you drink at PDGA events. So yeah, I finally realized that although I was obviously never going to be a professional disc golfer for a host of reasons, it is still, after almost 15 years or more than 15 years, my main hobby. I try to play two or three times a week. I love it, and I've been following professional disc golf avidly for a long time. Finally, I just started reaching out to players if I could find a method to contact them and just saying, hey, listen, how do you feel about your mental game? And also, side note, huge fan. I'm going to try not to be a fanboy in this email. So, I try to dial it back a notch. But yeah, I've had people say to me, the reason I responded to your email is because you said you were a disc golfer.
Yeah,
And
knowing
it.
enough about the culture of disc golf and the ecosystem, being able to like speak the same language as
Yeah.
someone in disc golf, I'm sure is a big plus because you can understand exactly what they're going through.
Right. I go through all the same motions they do, just with no pressure. They describe to me standing, 22 feet from the basket, knowing that this next putt is the whole weekend. And I know that level of stress and I know the actions that they're going through. So I think that helps us forge kind of a connection. One of the things I found out over the first few years is working with people that you could be friends with, that you share some sort of connection to, is much more rewarding for both parties than if you're working with someone where you don't really have anything in common. But this isn't therapy. This isn't medical advice or medical attention. This is something different. And that connection really helps. And having the shared disc golf experience, even though they're at vastly different levels, is something that I think is comforting and insightful for a lot of people. So I do a free consultation, just sort of a 20 or 30 minute chat where we can just kind of decide if we're a good fit to work together. What are they looking for exactly? What are the issues in their mental game? What else have they tried? How do they feel on the course? What's their experience right now? How would they like to feel? Do they have a concrete goal? And then, do I feel I can help them? Do we have that connection that I was talking about? Does what I do sound reasonable and practical and approachable to them? So it's kind of a mutual, they tell me what they're looking for and what they've tried, and I tell them what I offer and whether I think I can help. And we just sort of decide together, like, would you like to try this? And if we proceed, it's just kind of meeting once a week. Sometimes once every couple weeks. In the beginning, it's pretty important to meet reasonably frequently, as that's when the most questions tend to come up as these new techniques of meditation or mindfulness kind of get unrolled for the client. But we just start where they are. We start on a fairly small scale and just build up from there. And then we watch for the results that they're interested in. And if those don't start happening, then we modify the training. Little tweaks and adjustments all along the way to just make sure that they're progressing the way they want to. It's not a, there isn't one or two techniques that I just give to everybody and hope for the best. It's dozens and dozens and dozens of techniques that can all be combined in different ways for different results.
I would love to hear more about what you mentioned earlier, the concentration, the clarity, and equanimity.
The definitions are, we try to keep them reasonably simple. Concentration is the ability to put your attention on what you want for as long as you want and keep it there. Clarity is the ability to untangle and understand your sensory experience, both internal and external, in real time as it's happening. And then equanimity is sort of a radical non-interference with the flow of sensory experience. So it's allowing everything to kind of come and go naturally without getting pushed and pulled by it as much.
When I'm playing around, I feel myself like going into these different states, you know. If I'm like in, I call it like my rising state when I just like start to catch fire, and then I have like a faltering state and a static state, and like my round depends on like how long I'm able to stay in that state. So like that last one you were talking about, equanimity, is like, yes, like just being able to stay in that flow. If I'm rising, stay rising, or if something happens, like not go into like starting to
Yes,
falter, like.
that's exactly it. And that's a great example. And you used the word states and then said often your round is dependent on those states. Mindfulness training is about creating traits, not states. So
Ooh, I
those
love
states
that.
of mind that we don't really control exactly, they kind of come and go on their own, right? Like you may not even notice the thing that makes you falter slightly. And then all of a sudden, two holes later, you're like, why is everything going to hell? But that momentum is hard to break, right?
Yeah.
So once it starts rising, a lot of times it tends to stay rising. And once it starts falling, it tends to stay falling. Those are the states that we work with. But concentration, clarity, and equanimity are traits. that get rewired in our brain, and they enable us to work within those states in a much better way. It enables us to go with those flow states in a way that is more complete and connected, and to disidentify with the faltering states in a way that makes it less personal and breaks its momentum. You may be rising, you may be falling, but as your concentration, clarity, and equanimity increase, those states become less important. As your baseline continues to rise, your resilience continues to rise. Those, because you can enjoy the rising when it happens, but you cannot get pushed around or take it personally or feel, dejected when it starts to fall. Your skills stay high, even though your traits stay up there, even though the states fluctuate.
Oh, I love that so much. I love the distinction of like traits, not states, because states feel so out of control. It's like I'm put into this situation versus traits are like, this is something I can learn and work on and like grow, like it's a muscle. And the longer I practice that, the better I become. I can control what state I'm in, basically, because I've gained these traits.
So as far as like specific examples, just some ways I work with people and some ways I use it in my own game, concentration, that would allow you to focus more tightly on the specific shot you need to throw right then. So if your attention is 90 or 100% on executing the throw, then it's not on the gallery or background noise or nerves. All that stuff is still there, but you are tightly focused on the physical activity of throwing the shot that you have already envisioned, right? So envisioning your line, creating your line mentally is much faster and smoother. Keeping your focus on what needs to be done physically to execute it is also tighter and more focused. And then clarity, maybe you're sitting there pre-round, you're feeling the pre-round jitters. Those are normal and healthy. Like if you didn't have any jitters, then you may not be involved enough for that to work out. Jitters are pretty typical and pretty healthy. But you would be able to more easily identify when something like that becomes anxiety or trauma or unmanageable stress. The difference is not always apparent because everything in our day-to-day lives can be kind of a mishmash emotionally, just a big ball of emotions. Clarity allows you to really discern and identify emotions, understand them more deeply, and then make better decisions on the course based on a better connection. Because we make so many of our decisions based on our emotional responses. That's just kind of our emotions are a behavioral guidance system. So learning to see them, hear them, and feel them much more clearly leads to a lot more clear thinking and clear decision making. And then equanimity, being able to allow the flow of all those emotions and reactions on the course come and go without getting swept away by them. So it's not that you don't feel the stress. It's not that you don't feel trepidation at lining up a putt that you have to sink. All of that is still there, and we're not ignoring it. As our skill, as that muscle, as you said, of equanimity gets stronger, then that stuff can happen without adversely affecting us quite so much.
Where were you last week? I had a tournament last week that would have been so helpful. I had this moment on hole 16 and I had just tied with like second place. So it was like, okay, I can get second place. Like I came in way behind and had come back. My opponent like kind of shanks their shot and I was like, all right, now you have it. It's right in front of you. 150 foot upshot straight in front of you. And I shanked it. And I had the same exact shot on 17 and 18. And like, because I had missed it on 16, I could not shake it off. Like, I had to line up the same shot in the same hole. And it was like, okay, you can get another stroke here too. It's okay that you missed that one, but like, don't mess it up. I just shanked it again and then shanked it again. It was like, oh, because I'd done it that one time, like it got in my head and I couldn't like rebalance after it.
So imagine that being a more of a one and done situation. Imagine the more those skills increase and interplay, the less things like that leave a residue. You shanked that upshot, which you have probably thrown dead where you want it and parked it 1,000 times. But this time, you shanked it. And then you shank the next two because the residue of that first one, emotionally and mentally, was still
Yes, it's
there.
such a good word for it. It's exactly right.
So equanimity reduces friction. And the less friction there is, the less residue there is. So if that experience could just pass through, you might be pissed, you might be hurt, you might be sad, but that doesn't have to carry with you for the final three holes. If you can experience those things as they surge through as you're walking to your next shot, and then by the time you line it up, those things are mostly gone because you didn't resist them. The resistance is what makes them all sticky and creates all that friction. Equanimity lowers the resistance to them, and so they just pass through a lot more smoothly.
When we talked before, you mentioned how like working on your, overall mental health, whether it's like personal or professional, if you're a professional disc golfer, or even if you're just trying to translate those skills to your mental game, like overall, your mental health comes with you. We kind of talked about how like your physical preparation doesn't start the second you walk onto the course. Like your physical preparation is in doing field work and eating right and getting enough sleep, but like we don't have the same kind of practices for our mental health in that way, where it's like I'm making sure my relationships are good and my self-confidence and self-love is there, and all of these things where your mental health outside the course, you can be prepping your mental game outside the course just in your daily life, and you should the same way you do your physical.
The highest level competitors, that might be what separates them from the pack, is that sort of clarity and understanding around what needs to be done and finding the right people to connect to help with the mental game. Finding people to help with the physical game seems maybe a little easier. It's expected. It's something that everyone has. People have strength and conditioning coaches, people have cardio coaches, people have dietitians and physical therapists. The physical side of the game, everyone expects you to pursue in as many different angles as possible to give you the edge. And I think it's just now coming into focus that people are doing the same thing with the mental game. But as you and I have talked about before, our society really stigmatizes anything around mental health. It sweeps it under the carpet and it shoves people away and it makes sure that they can't find the help that they need, or that if they're looking for it, they feel bad about looking for it because of the response they get. And I just hate that. The things that you do in strength and conditioning and with your diet and with physical therapy don't just help your game, they help your overall physical health, but they can be custom tailored for the game. And the same thing with mindfulness training, it can be custom tailored for an individual specific game and the results they're looking for. But at the end of the day, it doesn't stop on the course. It's mental health that carries over into every aspect of their lives. It fundamentally reduces suffering and increases happiness. Mindfulness is, it exists on a spectrum, just like physical fitness. You can go to the gym just because you want to look better on vacation. You can go to the gym specifically to lose weight. You can go to the gym specifically to rehab an injury. Or you can go to become an Olympic class athlete and compete at a level that almost 100% of the population will never achieve. And it's the same thing with mindfulness training. The mental challenges are different, just like the physical challenges are different. So you can absolutely, with the help of a skilled teacher, make sure that what you're doing addresses exactly what you want addressed. And if over time that changes, a good coach can help you change it. A lot of my clients started out, I'm thinking of one person in particular, they started out looking for relief from ADHD and social anxiety. And they now meditate 35 minutes a day, 7 days a week, and they're looking for the complete deep end of the pool of benefits, losing the boundaries around the limited ideas of self opening up their awareness into a space where all
Oh, I love
possibilities
that.
can coexist. And they've just jumped in 4 years. They've jumped from the shallow end straight into the deep end. And I say shallow end to deep end. The shallow end isn't pejorative. The deep end isn't better.
Yeah,
It's just a
right.
matter of how much you want out of it.
I liked what you were saying about like the magnified happiness and reduced suffering. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
The primary thing that creates suffering in our lives is resistance. Something bad happens to us, and we spend a lot of mental energy on things like, well, why is this happening to me? I'm a good person. All I needed was to have a good day today, and I'm having a shitty day. This isn't fair. Why should I be going through this right now? Any sort of pain or discomfort, mental or physical, that comes our way, our natural instinct is to push it away. We don't want to experience it. And with happiness, with pleasure, with lovely things that come our way, our instinct is to hold on to them desperately no matter what. So pain, we want to go away. Happiness, we want to never leave. Mindfulness training allows you to experience pain and joy without as much resistance. The pain doesn't translate as deeply into suffering. It doesn't lessen your experience of the pain, but it certainly lessens your experience of suffering associated with it. If you break your leg, there's a big difference between the suffering associated with it if you spend 2 months not leaving the house and complaining to everyone that this wasn't fair, you didn't deserve this, why did this have to happen to you, versus staying out and about. I mean, we're not talking about positive mental attitude, just staying bubbly. We're talking about, hey, my leg got broken. It wasn't personal. It wasn't the universe out to get me. I'm going to do my physical therapy. I'm going to do what needs to be done. And when the cast is ready to come off, the cast comes off, and I'm going to be right back at it. There's still pain associated there, but there's not as much suffering. If you can let the mental and emotional resistance to that pain come and go without trying to push it away, then it leaves without that residue that we were talking about. And you can experience the pain of the actual broken leg and the recuperation without having to be mired down in the suffering, the mental and emotional aspect that comes along with it. And then the same thing with happiness. If you can experience the pure joy of your child being born without grasping onto it and thinking, this level of happiness is sublime, I hope it never goes away. And then when it does start to fade or go away, there's a suffering that comes along with that because you're like, well, why can't I have that all the time? With the skills of mindfulness that build up, you can experience that happiness on a much higher level. And as it starts to fade and it lives its natural life and moves on, you lose a lot of that grasping. So again, that residue is gone. You don't look back years later and go, oh, that was a high point. I wish I could go back to that. You look back on it and go, oh my God, that was a high point. That was amazing. You're not comparing it to your current circumstances. You can live it and relive it with a sort of depth and purity that you don't have when you're trying to make the good times stay and make the bad times go away.
I was wondering if you had any small exercises or like best practices that people could do at home or on the course to be more mindful, after or before around.
So I will present this as a kind of a formal practice in stillness. So like we're both sitting down, we're both in quiet rooms, so we can just chill out for a few minutes and close our eyes and do this practice. And then I'll explain how to translate it to the course, if that's cool.
Cool. I'm about it. Yeah, let's do it.
So you can do this with your eyes open. You can do it with them closed. So yeah, just settle into a posture, something that you can sustain for the next few minutes reasonably comfortably. So let's create a little bit of rest. So go ahead and bunch your shoulders up around your neck, like you're really stressed out. Like just tighten them up there around. Yep. And now relax them. It's better that way, right? It's better when
Oh, yeah.
it's relaxed. Yeah. All right. So we're going to do it again in a second. But when you get them bunched up around your shoulders, we're going to leave them there for about 5 seconds. And then when you relax them, I want you to keep your attention on that feeling that comes with the muscles being released and all of that tension sort of ebbing away as the muscles relax back into a restful state, right? So bunch them up, keep them up around your shoulders. Notice how tight and unpleasant that is. I'm actually getting a cramp. And go ahead and relax them, drop them, and keep your attention on the same spots. Notice how much more relaxing and restful it is as all that tension ebbs away. And stay with it. Keep your attention there on your shoulders. What does that rest feel like? Whatever it is, however it specifically is there, just let your attention stay with those muscles that aren't contracted, that aren't bunched up, that aren't really activated. That's what we call feel rest. And just let your attention sort of soak into that absence of activity. It's a little counterintuitive at first to put your attention on a lack of something. But it's sort of like closing our eyes. You know, we can keep our eyes open and we can see what's directly in front of us. And then we close our eyes. It's not jet black. You know, it's not totally blank. There's light filtering through the capillaries. There's light colors that kind of swirl around. So even though it's an absence of sight, it's not a total absence. Same thing with feel rest. You can move your attention to a part of your body that, compared to a lot of other places, is far less active, and just let your attention soak into that nice, restful, nothing is happening here sort of peace. How is
I
that for you?
loved that. It was
Cool.
great. I don't know why it was like the palms of my hands or like the backs of my hand. For some reason, it's like they don't do a thing. They are lazy AF. They're just chilling. That's where the good stuff is.
Yeah, no, that's perfect. Everybody
I
finds a
love
few
it.
spots that are their go-tos. You know, I work with a lot of clients on the course for this. So yeah, you're at 18 feet out and you know you have to make this. Everybody else is lining up their putts and getting ready. You're going to be the last one to toss. While you're standing there with your cart or your bag, while you're waiting, can you place your attention somewhere away from all of the nerves, the anxiety, the stress? Can you find a place on your body that isn't particularly active? So you're standing up, so maybe not the feet, but your hands might be hanging at your side. They might be on the handle of your cart. They could be a place where there's not a lot of activity. The elbows, the earlobes. You know yourself, you know your body. You will be able to find a couple of spots where you can routinely find rest. So you can do that for 10 or 15 seconds while someone else is putting. You can do it for 10 or 15 seconds while the last person in front of you puts. You can step up to your lie with your putter, get everything settled, go through your pre-shot routine, and for the last 5 seconds before you throw, you can find it again. And essentially, what you're doing is you're building a momentary burst of concentration because you're putting your attention in a very specific spot and keeping it there. You're building clarity because you're paying attention to a very specific thing in a very close and clear way. And you're building equanimity because while you're doing that, all the shit's still going on in the background. The voices in the head, the nerves, the stress, the gallery. All of that is still going on, even though
The
you're focused on
residue from the last putt, because
residue from the last putt.
because we're not pros at this yet.
But you don't have to do anything about all of that stuff because what you're doing is paying attention to a small spot of rest in your body, and you're building those three skills, and you're navigating away from all of the tumult so that you have a greater chance of walking up to your lie with a little bit of that peace and rest that you were just paying attention to.
If you have one thing that you want people to take away from listening to your episode, what would it be?
Take care of your mental health and don't worry about how it looks. You know, I was going to relate it to myself. You know, my approach isn't really typical. You know, I'm not a speak softly and stay calm sort of mindfulness coach, right? That doesn't work for me. Doesn't work for a lot of my clients. My methodology is about engaging with life at every level, being just like a passionate part of this whole cluster that we're going through, right? I don't train people to be calm and detached. I train them to
Right.
find calm, to find peace, to generate it and create it and notice it and use it when they can. But I teach mindfulness with a lot of playfulness and irreverence and some cursing, you know, that's just my personality. But I also came to mindfulness from a place of massive suffering. I know what it's like to be just hopeless and miserable and out of control and to feel like you can't change anything. I learned to work with that, to work with myself to reduce that suffering. So that's where I kind of teach from that ex my experience in that awful place, but with a lot of light and warmth and humor. I'm not for everybody. But this is a highly particular, intimate thing that we're doing. It's very unique and individual and personalized. And if people are interested in improving their game or improving their mental health, you know, you should look around and find someone that you have a connection with, someone that you feel can understand and get on board with what you're going through and what you're doing. And yeah, I think that's the first step towards normalizing all of this and really making the whole population feel like, hey, this is just another facet of existence we all have to take care of.
I love it so much. Thank you so much for coming on and all of your expertise.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. This was great.
If you want to connect with Brent, shoot the shit, learn more, or get a free consultation session with him, you can go to his website, brentpurpleoliver.com, or contact him on his social media at thepurpleoliver. Links to both are in the show notes. If you have your own perspective on mental game, mindfulness, or a story to share, email me at discgolfbasketcase@gmail.com or reach out on social media and we will make it happen. As always, if you like the show, rate, review, and follow us. It helps the podcast get discovered, climb the charts, get more sponsors, all the things. So a little review can go a long way. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, full send, everybody. No guts, no glory. No brains, no chains. Goodbye.